Hey, and thanks for listening. This is Conversations, the True Voice Media podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Gibbard. Let's get started. Today, I have on the call, on the podcast, Abby Diedemann. And Abby is going to talk to us a little bit about disaster planning and disasters and the intersection between that and social media. So, Abby, do us all a favor and tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and all that sort of good stuff.
Sure thing. I'm Abby Diedemann, as he said. I run a technology consulting business, but my true passion, I guess, is in disaster response, meaning domestic natural disasters, hurricane, flooding, tornado, that kind of thing. I've been doing that since Hurricane Katrina. So I just kind of mixing my two loves here, technology and effective disaster response, and that's how I ended up where I am now.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, I mean, obviously it's not, in many ways, it's not like the sexy side of social media.
No, definitely not.
Dealing with some pretty heavy stuff. So the place where I'd love to start with this, and this is totally a question from my own bias, but you said something really interesting as we were going back and forth setting this up. You know, you gave me a little bit of your history and you talked a little bit about things recently, and you said something along the lines of you fell back in love with Facebook because of recent events, and then the part that really intrigued me, edge rank and all. Okay, so we have to talk about that because I am, as many people know that have either read my blog, listened to the podcast, or met me in person, I am a huge anti-EdgeRank person. And especially when it comes to something like disaster recovery, the first thing that comes across my mind is, why the hell would EdgeRank benefit in a circumstance like that? So let's talk about it. Tell me why EdgeRank is a good thing as somebody who deals in disaster response.
Well, number one is images are really huge in disaster response as far as getting the word out, and EdgeRank, as you know, loves images. So I stick an image with pretty much, almost all of my posts, and they're really, I don't know if provocative is the right word, but really interesting images that get people talking about it and people sharing it. So I put really important information in the post, and just stick an image of, you know, the my hometown recently got flooded, so I'm right in the midst of it here in upstate New York, and put a recent photo of either the recovery efforts or the flooding, and you know, people love sharing that kind of thing, and Facebook loves it because it's full image and not a lot of text, and I don't put a lot of links on there. I just try to keep it short and sweet, and it's really kind of benefited me. My business is kind of different than that, and I've had, as many business owners have, a lot of trouble getting reach with my business Facebook page. But with the disaster response end of it, Facebook has kind of been my go-to platform. So,
gotcha. But do you think, you know, just because I want to push back on it, because I am so very opinionated on this particular topic. But so let's say that there was no EdgeRank and you still use those images and people still respond well to images, and there was no algorithm dictating this is something that does or does not get exposure.
Sure.
How does the presence of EdgeRank, of an algorithm that maybe favors images, even though, you know, even though you're using images, it favors images, how does it help you to, I mean, I get that it favors what you're using, but how does it actually make it easier for you? Because if you want to put something up there that has no image, doesn't it then make it more difficult for you in a scenario where the stakes are really actually pretty high?
Oh, for sure. For sure. And I'm not, go EdgeRank, it's awesome. That's not kind of my point at all, but I've kind of figured it out, I think, in this aspect. But yeah, there's definitely been posts where it's been a pain in the butt. I said I don't use a lot of links, but the links that I do use are links to like the Governor Cuomo just released how to apply for aid for homeowners to replace appliances and that kind of thing that were damaged. Well, there's nothing I can do other than post a link and say, here's the link to how to apply, and you know, that kind of thing. Yeah, it's definitely still hard for me. I'm not saying that EdgeRank has been, you know, the best for me, but it's definitely in this scenario, I've kind of learned how to fool around with it.
Kind of how to game it and manipulate it.
Game so that it. You that's, can, that's a good word.
Gotcha. So basically, it's not so much that you've fallen in love with that drink, but you've figured out how to use it in this particular scenario to reach the people when you wouldn't otherwise have organically reached them.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. So let's then shift gears and look at Twitter. And something that I've read a lot about, throughout the years as different disasters have happened, is the role of Twitter in disaster response. So as someone who works in that field and is dealing with it, how much do you find yourself using Twitter versus Facebook? And is there a particular reason why one works better for you or another, or are they both integral parts of the disaster response?
I think they're both huge. Me personally, I use Twitter all the time just for my personal, it's turned into my news feed, really, that's where I get my news from. And where I'm located in upstate New York, in a small town in upstate New York, which is kind of a not so tech savvy area, Facebook has worked really well for me because that's where everybody is. But as far as getting the information to share with the people on Facebook, I get it from Twitter. So it's kind of interesting. In general, in the whole kind of disaster response industry, I guess is the right word, but Twitter has played a huge role because of the instant, you're getting the information as it comes, little pieces, and that's what people need as far as, fire on 6th Street and, flooding downtown, shelter opened up on this street. You just need those little sound bites, which, obviously Twitter is the best at. And as far as reaching everyone, if they're following you on Twitter, you're getting that information to them. So,
yep.
So Twitter has been really, really great in that area. And then on the recovery side, I found Facebook to be really good because people pop on and, can look at it on my page. It's one of those pages that in Facebook, it's weird because a lot of pages don't have that where people are going on your page and kind of looking at it. Mm-hmm. I found on my page, that's how people are doing it. They're popping on there once a day and kind of looking through the information. And I've reached a lot of people that way on Facebook, which is kind of odd, I think, for me. But yeah, both platforms have definitely been huge for disaster response.
So something about Twitter that I've always been really curious about, particularly in the disaster response space, is, Twitter was one of the first to really implement geotagging and,
right.
In a very precise way. And it always appeared to me that Twitter would be so good for disaster recovery and disaster response because you're dealing with people who may be in certain areas of a town or another or in certain areas of a state or another, and you can really pinpoint where things are coming from and identify trends that way. Have you found in your work in disaster response that the geotargeting has been a factor or not?
Yeah, absolutely. Tennessee had some flooding a couple years ago, and they used it extensively with the geotagging to find out because, the people making the policies and the people sending out the firemen and the people in charge of the police and all that, they're not down in the trenches where the flooding is, so they're not even sure where everything's happening.
Mm-hmm.
So they used Twitter a lot with the geotagging on where it was happening, where the issues were. It's something that, other than having somebody flying overhead, that they would have no idea where the pockets in something like flooding, pockets of it go in different areas of the town. And so, yeah, it's definitely been a huge factor for disaster response.
Gotcha. So, there's the geotagging, but another thing that I think Twitter has really brought into the mainstream, and now you can see it having, Facebook has adopted and Instagram had previously, is hashtags.
Yep.
Do you think as in your work with, government agencies or any sort of an agency that needs to have a response plan in place, have you provided them with any sort of best practices around getting the word out around hashtags or around certain ways to organize the conversation so that people can best be heard and, have their issues dealt with?
That's definitely something that I'm working on right now, and especially now hyper-locally in an area where some of the government officials may not be as familiar with Twitter. But in disaster response and all across disaster response, this isn't just in the area of social media, preparation is key. So, you know, you hop on Twitter in a disaster to get some information, or you hop on Facebook, but once you're there, where are you going to go, or where are you going to look? And so if the government agencies and the nonprofit organizations provide those ahead of time, you know, in the event of a disaster, you know, hashtag Oneida disaster, we'll have all the information up there for you. That's definitely something that I'm trying to educate, especially smaller communities on that may not, you know, have that education already.
Mm-hmm. And I'd imagine one of the tough parts is that you never know when a disaster is going to strike, number one.
Yep.
In most cases, you may have a little window of time beforehand. But in addition to not knowing when it's going to strike, there's also the are people going to pay attention unless there's imminent danger? So let's say you continually have up, you know, a billboard by train stations or, you know, a billboard somewhere else, or you run a television ad. Are people paying attention if there's not actual imminent danger? So how do you get that word out there before, you know, it hits the fan, so to speak?
Oh, that's absolutely the struggle. That's the struggle on, you know, everybody should have a flood kit in their house, you know, with food and flashlights and, and do you know where your flashlights are in your house if you don't see the news that there might be a big storm coming? Like, do you even think about where your flashlights and your candles are on a daily basis? No, absolutely not.
Yeah, so. I don't even have candles, and my flashlight is my iPhone. And if I can't plug that in, well, I'm screwed. And I have a 5,
right,
so it's dying all the time.
So, you know, so this isn't unique to, you know, educating people about where to go on social media. It's a struggle with disaster response all across. You know, people don't have basic necessities, basic food. If you're without power for 3 days, you know, what's your situation going to be? And then it's probably the same as most people's, you know, it's going to be bad.
Yeah, absolutely. So what would you say are some of the best practices? And I'd love to hear your perspective on kind of both sides of this. What are some of the best practices for potential disaster victims, that is the population at large, before anything actually happens, for them to be prepared from a social media perspective to stay informed, to know where to go, et cetera. What's a best practice there? And then on the other side of it, what are some of the best practices that organizations, either governmental or even I'm thinking, what's the disaster protocol for professional services agencies and just businesses at large? How do they keep themselves prepared or, you know, ahead of the curve when it comes to disaster planning and response?
Sure. Well, the first thing is be on social media. So that's a big thing for, you wouldn't think, but like, you know, where I'm from, City of Oneida, they don't have a Facebook page, City of Oneida. The City of Oneida clerk's office has a Facebook page that happens to have a lot of good information on it, but that wouldn't be the first place I would look. So you want to make it easy to find for your constituents here. The City of Oneida Fire Department, which has a Facebook page, they've posted their, you know, made events for their chicken barbecues and whatnot. The day that the flooding happened, they had a post up that said, hey, sorry, our admin of this page is on vacation and nobody knows how to use it, so you'll have to go elsewhere for the information. Next week we'll have some good information for you. And that just kind of, like, killed me. I'm like, this is the kind of planning that you have to have. Okay, if your admin's on vacation when a disaster strikes, somebody should be able to update the Facebook page and say, hey, you know, here's the info that you need. Here's where the, you know, the shelters are, that kind of thing.
Yeah, seriously, so, it's not like they're you know, launching a rocket to make it to the moon. You know, we're talking about a Facebook page.
No, and the thing that cracked me up is somebody was smart enough to get on the Facebook page and post that, so why they couldn't just post the information.
Yeah, right. We don't know how to attach a link to this thing.
So, I mean, so it's that kind of preparation. It's simple, but, you know, that's where people are going to look. If I'm, you know, in the City of Oneida and something happens and I'm like, you know, I really need some legitimate information from an organization, first thing I searched personally was, okay, Oneida Red Cross, Oneida, City of Oneida Police Department, City of Oneida Fire Department, to see what they had up. And, you know, it was pretty dismal, actually. So, and then from the other end of it, as far as, you know, potential victims or people in that situation, is kind of research what the social media space in your community looks like. If you're in a bigger community or a bigger city, they even have, you know, New York City Emergency Management page will have a, you know, their own page dedicated to this kind of thing. If you're in a smaller community, you know, your city at the very least should have some sort of social media presence, and finding out where that is is definitely crucial. And what organizations, every town has their different organizations, their Red Crosses, UMCOR, which is what I'm affiliated with, which is the United Methodist Committee on Relief. You know, what's in your community as far as resources are, and, you know, where to look. So,
yeah, you know, it's funny. It seems like it would be probably a smart move if Twitter were to be able to implement something where, you know, how there's you get a limit of 20 lists. It seems like it would be a good thing to be able to, by your geotag or by general area of where your tweets are coming from, add an additional list that's sort of like the 911 list.
Emergency, yeah, that would be great.
So Twitter, if you're listening, you should do that. seems like that would be probably pretty smart. But from the perspective of the organizations, the governmental agencies, you know, you work with some of these agencies and you've seen from the side of a resident, you know, some agencies being unprepared. What are some of the first steps that you would recommend that they take to go about preparing themselves for, you know, the potential of disaster, and how to use social media to respond to that?
Well, the first step is, and it doesn't have to be somebody high up in the organization. I think that's what some of them are afraid of. Like, the mayor does not have to be updating the City of Oneida Facebook page, you know. Get a 20-year-old, you know, clerk to do that for you. And the first steps, you know, like I said earlier, be on social media. The second step is putting a plan in place like you would any kind of disaster plan. Who's going to communicate the information? What information is going to be communicated? Somebody has to be able to respond to questions. You know, that's a huge one. You can't have somebody pop on there twice a day, because once you're considered an authority on the subject, people are going to ask you questions. I had one person on our disaster page here in Oneida. They said, oh, I know the Red Cross shelter is set up at the local Y, but where else can I go? So I didn't know how to answer it, so I replied to him, oh, well, you know, this place has food, this place has, you know, blankets and cleaning supplies, what are you looking for? She goes, no, where do I go in an emergency? And I'm thinking to myself, what's happening here? Is she having a heart attack? Like, is there an electric issue? You know, what is the issue? So, you know, you have to reply back. You can still call 911, and the hospital's still up and running. And, you know,
yeah.
And it's that kind of thing that somebody has to be prepared to do. And it, like I said, it doesn't have to be the mayor. It doesn't have to be the police chief. It doesn't have to be anything like that. But it has to be somebody that can be in communication with those people. So you definitely have to have somebody that you can, you know, station at a laptop or even on a smartphone. I've updated a lot of stuff, you know, from the ground on my smartphone that can update information as it changes and can answer questions, you know, as mundane and silly as some of these questions are coming in. I mean, they're not that way to the people that are sending them out. So, and rumor control is a huge thing too. We had an animal hospital here in town that got flooded. And there was a rumor that started pretty quick on social media that they had euthanized a good portion of their animals in preparation for the flood, which was not true at all. And so you have to have somebody, you know, that's kind of is savvy enough to research what the talk is on Twitter and Facebook about the disaster and be able to respond to that. So those would be my three prep list there.
Very good. Well, I think most government agencies would be very smart to heed that advice. One more question before we wrap up. I wanted to ask you about what sort of tools you recommend for agencies that are serious about disaster response. Are you a proponent of using the freely available, sort of as long as you have a Facebook page and you're monitoring and you're using basic Twitter search? Or do you recommend using sort of higher level tools that allow agencies to, you know, maybe like a social listening tool like a Sysimos or a Brandwatch? And is that the sort of thing that needs to happen full-time or only during disasters?
Well, it definitely depends. You know, if you're running, you know, the disaster response organization for something like Hurricane Sandy, which is, you know, covering a large metropolitan area and a large, you know, geographical area, then absolutely, certainly there's more advanced tools for that kind of thing. But if you're in a, you know, small area that, you know, or even like in the Midwest where there's tornadoes, where it's sporadic, you know, the free tools have worked great for what we're dealing with here. It's a small geographical area. It's limited to, you know, three or four major disaster areas. and it's full time once the disaster strikes. But you know, other than that, it's, you know, once a week putting an update on preparation for floods, or you know, how to volunteer for the Red Cross and that kind of information. So, you know, if it's a small town that's thinking about getting into disaster response and figuring out how to do it, you know, the free tools are working great. But, you know, if you're a higher up in a bigger chain of command, there's all sorts of paid tools that are, and there's tools that are geared towards disaster response. So.
Right on. Okay, cool. Well, I think this gives us a really good overview of the disaster response, and I think that it would be interesting to have you come back, especially after a disaster, and kind of maybe do a little breakdown of what happened and where you saw there were you know, opportunities to improve it or anything like that. But I want to thank you for coming on and talking with me a little bit about disaster response. It was definitely eye-opening and interesting. But before we go, why don't you tell everybody listening where they can go to connect with you online and learn more about what you do?
Sure. I'm at DiedemannTech.com is my website, and Diedemann, the best way to remember how to spell it is Diet E-Man. It's Dieteman tech.com, and I'm on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, the whole shebang from under Diedemann Tech. So
awesome. Well, thank you for coming on, and yeah, thanks. Basically,
all
just
right.
Thank you for coming
thanks on. Thanks for asking me. I'd love to come back.
Yeah, we're going to be doing this, you know, plenty of episodes, and there's plenty for us to talk about, and there's plenty to talk about in disasters, so I'm sure we'll have a lot more to talk about in the future.
First, sure thing.
All right, so for all of you out there listening, this has been Conversations, the True Voice Media Podcast. Take care.